excited to start a new series today and dive into a book that I have loved for a very long time. It's one of my favorite books of the Bible. As we get started, I want you to just come with me to a moment in your life. I don't know what you do when bad news arrives. When you get that phone call and all of a sudden you hear news you didn't expect, stunning news, news that's heartbreaking and heartrending. Does anyone else sit down first? I kind of sit, when I get really bad news, it's kind of like hearing a lot of things at the same time, or like three people are telling you bad news at the same time, and I kind of like just go, wait, everyone, shh, just hold on. I just need to sit down. Whew, okay, sorry. Say it again, because I feel like I heard you say something really disastrous. There's been a few moments in my life where I've had to sit down and get some really bad news, and I don't know what your stance is or how you handle that, but that first thought that runs through your mind is typically, you know, compassion, or maybe it's empathy, or just sadness and pain. You think about just recent events that have happened in our country over the last few years. Who could miss this past week the coverage of the 9/11 anniversary? I think that's one of those events where we all know where we were when we saw the second plane hit, or when we first heard what was going on. Just seared into our mind as a nation, not only the event, but exactly what we were doing when we heard. It was just unthinkable. Or maybe when Hurricane Katrina hit and we saw the devastation, and we were just so appalled by the news coverage of seeing people sitting on their roofs and getting helicopter, you know, just those moments. Or maybe with this story, what happened in Newtown a year or so ago, with those small children. You hear these stories and you hear these moments and your heart just breaks, and you just sit and you're trying to process it. But have you ever had one of those moments where the bad news comes and it's heartbreaking, but you feel this strange compulsion, this thing you can't really explain, but it leads to sort of, you feel like you need to do something about it. Like you've heard the bad news, but then you're like, I really feel like I need to go and help. I know after 9/11, a lot of people enlisted and got involved in the armed forces because they just felt like they wanted to go do something about that. I know back in World War II time, a lot of things, you know, after things that had happened at Pearl Harbor, just, you know, it was like as a nation, we're like, we've got to go do something about this. And people felt like, to all, you know, contrary to all logic, or, you know, what you may have been doing with your life, or, you know, why would you drop everything and enlist when you've got this great career going? I just feel like I need to. I have to do this. You just have to understand, I have to go do this. Or maybe you have, in your own life, I don't know if you have someone like this in your family, but we've got a few that we know. When a really bad moment has happened, something to your maybe immediate family, and you have to make a phone call, who are you more apt to call? Someone who's going to give you sympathy and hang up the phone? Or someone who says this, that is awful, I'm so sorry that happened. Okay, you know what, don't tell me anything more. I'm gonna call you back from my car, I'm coming over right now. Where are your kids? What can I do? How can I take them? Where is it gonna be? Where do I need to go? Like, you know, we have that prayer. That's usually the first call we make when those earth-shattering moments happen, is that we need someone involved in this situation who's not just going to listen and be sympathetic and offer us like, well, I'm gonna pray for you. And that is important and that's great. But in those moments when we're in the trenches and we're hearing horrible news and our hearts are broken and something's affected us and we need help, we call those activators. We call those people that are going to not only hear and have a broken heart, but they're going to say, tell me on the way so I can get in my car. I just need to get dressed. It's 3 a.m. Have you ever had that moment in your life where you got really bad, heartbreaking news, or something really tragic happened, but it wasn't enough to just be sad that night and think about it and talk about it as a family and pray? There was something gnawing inside of you that said that I need to do something about this. A calling, even. We're starting this new series, and it's called Ruined. And the idea here, even with this graphic, is is that it's about the book of Nehemiah. And what's happened here in the book of Nehemiah is that Jerusalem has been destroyed for the most part. The walls are broken down. The gates are burning. It's a very vulnerable city. There's no protection from enemies that are all around the people that are living there. So I know in your mind you're thinking, okay, that looks very like kind of post-apocalyptic. I don't think the archaeological ruins would bear out skyscrapers in this, and that's true. But I wanted to use something that would give you sort of the idea of what this would be like in a modern city that sort of kind of bombed out and burned out, and it just, it's got an open pathway to loot what's there. So I want to just, we're going to walk through this book verse by verse, but I want to just set it in sort of its historical context, talk a little bit about maybe who wrote it and the dating and things like that, just to kind of get it set up in our minds. So I think when I talk about timelines with Israel and with history, I always try to sort of say, okay, which side of David did this occur? Because a lot of us are like, David, yes, I know David. When is that again? So David and King Solomon is right around 1000 BC to 950 BC-ish there. And so that's kind of when Israel, if you look at that, that's when Israel was at its absolute peak. You know, the temple, Solomon built the temple. It was gleaming and glistening, brand new, fresh, you know, just gorgeous. Nothing had been spoiled yet. All the jewels and all the gold and everything was just, it was just shining. And David had built that city of Jerusalem, and he was winning battles and conquering kingdoms, and they were military power, and Israel was feared by their enemies and by the other nations because they knew that God was with them. But this story occurs 500 years after that glory. Have you ever read through the Old Testament and been like, what is wrong with these people? When you read the list, especially in like Chronicles or Kings, where it kind of walks through the kings that ruled, and it's like, this king was great, and he honored the Lord, and he walked with the Lord, and God prospered their people, and the nation was great, and then he died, but then his son was evil in the eyes of the Lord. He turned his people from the Lord, and he rebuilt the high places and worshipped Asherah or whatever the gods were, and the people turned from God, and then the next king was more evil, and they turned from God, and then it's like, but then there was this great king who came in, you know, and he found the scrolls of Holy Scriptures, and he brought the people back, and he cut down the high places, and all the idol worship, got rid of it all, and returned the people to God. But then his son was evil. You know, it's like, you look at this, and I look at that, I'm like, what is wrong with them? Until I look at my own life, and I say, wow, okay, I guess that's true of me as well. Maybe not with the idol worship and cutting down poles, but just in my own affections and my own commitment to God and my own seasons where I was really close to him and serving him, and then seasons where I just turned my back on him. So Israel went through these seasons, and during one of these seasons, Jeremiah and other prophets were predicting and prophesying and saying that God is going to scatter us. If we don't turn from our wicked ways and don't return to God, God is going to take us as a people group, and we're going to be scattered. We're going to be oppressed. We're going to be abducted from our homes and taken. And in 586 BC, about 400 years after David, the height of David and Solomon, Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians came in and destroyed the temple and carried off all of the treasures of Israel, and including the best and the brightest young men. That's sort of the background for Daniel and his three friends happening. So they're carried off into captivity. And then about 50 years after that, in 539 BC, the Persians rose into a world power, and they toppled the Babylonians. And when your empire beats the old empire, all of the people and all of the stuff that belonged to the previous empire becomes yours. But there had been this amazing prophecy that said that King Cyrus would actually set free the Israelites that were being held in slavery and in captivity. He would let them go back. And what's amazing is they read it to him, said, this is you, you're supposed to do this. And he was so moved by that, and God changed his heart. He said, okay, go home. So most scholars put the number of Israelites in captivity in that Babylon area. When Cyrus said they could go home, it was about 150,000 were in captivity for 50 years, for about a generation. And of those 150 that were told to go back home, only 50 left. The rest wanted to stay where they were. They had set down roots. They knew that Jerusalem was going to be rough, and so they didn't go back. So that remnant returned to try to rebuild and reclaim Jerusalem. So they went back home in around 538, 539 BC. Well, 100 years has now gone by from when that remnant came back, and things are bad. They're trying to rebuild. Ezra the priest is there trying to oversee. He's trying to get permission from the Persians to rebuild the walls because they were at a very strategic point between Egypt and where the Persian Empire was really headquartered, and they were sort of right in the middle of it all. And if Jerusalem could be fortified and strong, that would actually, and Persia was sort of allies with them, that would help them. And so they started to rebuild, but then the Samaritans that were around there came and fought them and stopped the building. And so the walls now had been knocked back down. Things were burning. They were vulnerable. And that's where we are in the historical context of Nehemiah chapter 1. It's about 445 BC. And if you want to get really specific, they actually give us the month. Look at verse 1. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. Now it happened in the month of Kislev. And that's historically known to be November, December. In the 20th year, as I was in Susa, the capital, that Hanani, one of my brothers, came with certain men from Judah. And I asked them concerning the Jews who escaped, who had survived the exile, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said to me, the remnant there is in the province who had survived the exile is in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are destroyed by fire. So what's significant about this is that in the month of Kislev, that would be November, December, the city that it's placed in is Susa. It's called the Citadel of Susa. Now, Susa in the summertime got up to 130 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, if you're kind of an Arizona person, Phoenix, you say, oh, it's a dry heat. It's no big deal. We don't know what kind of heat, but 130 is like sticking your head in an oven, I think. You know, it's not a place you really want to be. It's like realizing why you got such a great deal on that trip to Florida when you literally melt on the surface of the sun standing in line for Space Mountain. Is that still a thing, Space Mountain? Somebody? Is it still open? Yes, okay. That's good. I was hoping that it would. I live Space Mountain. It's dark. It's a roller coaster in the pitch dark. It's really scary. I'll tell you how it goes next time I'm there. So it's 130 degrees in the summer, so therefore this place is not somewhere that you would go in the summer, but it was the winter palace of the Persian emperor and the Persian leadership. They would go there in the wintertime, like snowbirds would go from here to the south to stay away from the cold weather. So this is where it was, the Citadel of Susa, in the wintertime, November, December time, and Nehemiah gets news from the home front. Now remember, this is 100 years after Nehemiah's family would have had the opportunity to go back to Jerusalem. So if Nehemiah is still in Susa, which was one of the capital cities of Persia, serving the Persian king, his family decided to not go back with the remnant, and they decided to stay where they were. So for 100 years past when they could go, 150 years since they were originally brought out there by force, Nehemiah's family tree really is settled in, not so much in Jerusalem, but settled in the pagan world of Persia at this point, and Susa specifically. Now we find out later that Nehemiah had a high-ranking position. He was a cupbearer to the king, which is great. But that's not something that you just look at a 15-year-old and say, hey, can you just do this job for us? We need you. That's something that you work up to. That's something that you attain over time. So Nehemiah had a really good career. He had deep roots. But yet when he found out from his brother, we find out later this is actually his brother, coming back from Jerusalem, says, hey, how is the homeland? He gets the report that it's in bad shape. Now just to put this in some sort of personal context, I am 100% Norwegian, all the way back to the Vikings. So if you've seen that wooden ship and you've seen me wear my helmet with the horns on it, you know sometimes I try to get in touch with my roots, but not really. But we moved away here like 4 generations ago. I mean, I don't even know what the year was, but it was over 100 years ago. In fact, I guess our name was something else, and then when they got to Ellis Island, they were like, well, what's your father's name? And they said John, and said, okay, well, you're John's son. So that's kind of how we got our very rare, hard-to-find last name of Johnson. But, you know, when I hear news of things happening in Norway, I don't necessarily get stirred up by it. I mean, I'm from there. I'm Norwegian. That's where my homeland is. I've got a great story and history there. I'd really like to know what all happened there and what my relatives were involved in. But at the same time, you know, I'm not really thinking about Norway. I don't really care about it, to be honest. Maybe I'm a bad patriot or something. I don't know. But when I hear about things going on there, I'm not necessarily really thinking about it. I mean, if something really bad happened there, I'd feel bad about it. But I wouldn't necessarily feel compelled to move back. I think Norway's getting a little more popular now with the release of Frozen, because Arendelle is sort of like a Norwegian. They've popularized names like Sven and Olaf and fjords and all that kind of stuff, and the sweaters and lutefisk, the fish, all this stuff that I'm like, wow, this is like a lot of, I mean, I think it's Scandinavian, but I want to say it's Norway. I think Arendelle is fake, but you can let me know if you go and take the Frozen World Tour or whatever there is out there. But when I hear something happening in my home, I'm not really concerned about it, I'm not really thinking about it. So think about Nehemiah. He's been 100 years, his family's been, since they've been in this area, 150 years since the original exile, and yet he gets news, he's still concerned about his homeland. He still wants to know what's going on back in Jerusalem. When he gets this news, he finds out something horrible has happened. It's in really bad shape. Now that's the moment of decision for us. That's the moment where we make a response. So you hear something bad has happened, now what do you do? For me, I said, I sit down and I repeat it and I make everyone explain it to me very slowly, and then my heart hurts and I enter into kind of processing it. But in all truthfulness, I still go to bed. Later that night, I get up the next day. I'm still thinking about it. I'm still maybe researching what's going on. I want more developments. But when something bad has happened, it's more like I want to know about it but don't necessarily want to do anything about it. Nehemiah has a completely different response. Listen to what he says and does after he finds out the state of affairs in his homeland. Look at verse 4. As soon as I heard these words, I sat down and I wept and I mourned for days, and I continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven. Let's just stop there. So he hears this news, immediately he sits down as well. Now for him, sitting down wasn't just like me, like I need a chair and I need some space, I need to hear this again. This is a very much a Jewish way of mourning. They would sit down, you know, you've got stories where when something bad happens, you know, Job sits down and he tears his clothing from top to bottom and he puts ashes on his head, and there's a very formal and specific way to mourn, and it's definitely part of handling tragedy like this. So he hears this, immediately he takes it on. And he sits down and he weeps and he mourns, but then he goes further because he fasts and he prays as well. See, I think for myself, I kind of stop at the like mourning phase. I sit down and I may mourn. You know what? I may weep, depending on what's going on. I may be moved to tears. But that's kind of where it stops. I can't tell you that in any of these disasters that we've seen as a nation that I've stopped eating. Not stopped eating because I was sick to my stomach, but like chose to fast on behalf of those who aren't eating, on behalf of those who have been flushed out of their homes. I've prayed for them. But here's Nehemiah. He sits down, he weeps, he mourns, he fasts, and he prays. And it says he did this day and night. Day and night. This isn't the gather your family around and let's pray for those that were affected by this. This was day and night, fasting, weeping, mourning, praying. This was something he was owning. This was something he was entering into. And then his prayer is recorded. Listen to how he prays. It's a powerful prayer. Verse 5, and I said, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keeps his commandments. So stop there. Right away, I don't know about how you guys pray in these moments where it's like, guys, we just need to pray. Everyone come here, please. Can we all just pray? This is horrible. You know, let's just pray. And then I start and I say, God, we don't know why you allowed this to happen. God, or if it's just me, I'm like, God, why did you do this? Why is this happening? Why? I start with why a lot. What does Nehemiah start with? He starts with the greatness of God. He starts with O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commands. He doesn't start with, God, why did you let this happen to your people? God, why are you turning a blind eye to the suffering and pain? Why? Instead, he says, no, he focuses on who God is. Not the why of what happened, but the who of who God is. And he says, God, you are great. You are awesome. You are powerful. And you love those. There's a covenant here. You see what he does here very subtly? He says, you're great and you're awesome, you're powerful, but you also have made a covenant with this people. He's reminding God, God, don't forget. Don't forget what you promised that you would do. Don't forget to honor the covenant that you made. These people are loving you. These people are serving you. You know, we've walked away for sure, but you've made a promise and we want to obey you. We want to seek you out. He says, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant that I now pray before you day and night for the people of Israel, your servants, confessing the sins of the people of Israel, which we have sinned against you. Even I and my father's house have sinned. We have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, and the rules you commanded your servant Moses. Remember the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though your outcasts are in the uttermost parts of heaven, there from there I will gather them and bring them to the place that I have chosen to make my name dwell there. I love this. He says, he doesn't make any bones about the situation. He doesn't say, God, these are innocent people. They've done nothing wrong. He immediately owns the guilt and says, God, we've turned from you. God, we've sinned against you. We've broken our end of the deal. We've done this over and over and over again. Moses even told us. Moses said, if we do this, that you're going to scatter us. And obviously, you've scattered us. We're all over the world. But you also promised that if we return to you, you will bring us back together. I love, though, how Nehemiah, not only does he point out the failure of the nation, but he points out the failure of his own life and his family. It's powerful when you can be around a leader who doesn't act above everything else. He doesn't say, well, I've got it figured out, and the rest of you just need to sort of come along. But when there's an authentic and vulnerable moment where this leader, like Nehemiah does here, says, listen, my own house, I've failed you, God. I haven't done everything right. I'm not standing here like some kind of, he's not standing there like some kind of a martyr that's done everything right and needs to be just granted this favor. He's saying, we've all failed you, God, but yet you promised that if we return to you, you will gather us back together. And what I love is that in verse 10 he says, they are your servants and your people whom you have redeemed and by your great power and your strong hand. He's saying, these people that are in this distress, that are hurting like this, these are your people. These are your children. You rescued them with your strong hand. Listen to us. Don't forget your promise. We're going to return to you. We're going to come back to you, but we need you. Here's what I love. Listen to what he says in verse 11. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant, meaning to my prayer, and to the prayer of your servants who delight to fear your name. And give success to me, your servant, today, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man, meaning the king. In other words, he's saying, please hear my prayer and give me success in front of the king today. Here's what's amazing. That's an unbroken section. We find out at the beginning of chapter 2 that he heard this news in the month of Kislev, which is November, December. He finally gets his moment in front of the king in the month of Nisan, which is 4 months later. So just to give a little bit of a backtrack, 4 months ago today, give or take, was Mother's Day. That feels like a while ago to me. I don't know about you guys, but that's a long time. 4 months, that's 120 plus days, that's a while. So he was weeping, he's fasting, he's praying, he's mourning. He's raising this prayer to God. What's amazing is we don't have any scriptural evidence that this was a special prayer that he offered on the day he stood before the king. What it's suggesting to us is that this was his prayer every day. That every day he said, here's what's going on and here's the problem. And a lot of time that's where I stop. I stop with God. you know, will you please fix this area? Will you please bring people to yourself? Will you please intervene in this moment? And I stop short of saying, give me the chance to do it. Let me be the one. Give me the power to do it. God, grant me success. This is what I love, as he says, all this stuff is wrong. All this stuff is happening. Now I get to stand before the king. Will you give me success as I try to deal with this problem? I think about that. It's powerful because it's something that's saying, here am I, send me. It's not saying, God, there are so many problems in this city. God, there are so many problems with my neighbor's family. God, you know, my good friend just lost his job. Will you please help them? Or, you know, my brother-in-law has wandered away from you and he's gone. Will you just reach him? Or my dad just lost his job. Will you provide for us? All of those situations are different when we say, God, will you listen to my prayer? Here's what's going on. Please help me be a part of the solution. Will you let me be a part of this? Will you let me help my dad find a new job? Will you let me share my faith with my brother to see him come back? Will you use me to be a part of it? It's saying, I see the problem and I know it can't be fixed without you, but will you please use me to be a part of it? How humble is that? How willing is that? How amazing is that to say, like, I see the issues that surround us, but God, will you use me? Because I'm ready to go in. I can't do anything apart from you, but I'm ready. I'm ready every day for that moment to arrive. Grant me success in the presence of this king, because I want to do something about that ruined city that I love and that you love, God. And then Nehemiah saves the best for last. Normally, in these scriptural accounts, they start with what they did for a living. Normally, to say, Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah, cupbearer to the king. But instead, in true dramatic fashion, great screenwriting fashion, even, I would say, it's almost like he looks up and looks at the camera and says, by the way, I was the cupbearer to the king. Oh, I don't know if it did that, but you know, then the title splashes on the screen like, wow, this is going to be intense. What's amazing is he saves the best for last. He says, you know what? God, will you use me? Will you use me? I want to be a part of this. I want to fix it. And he says, oh, by the way, I'm actually going to be in front of the king today. Now, before you think this is some sort of sommelier or someone who just is like, oh, king, this has notes of citrus and herbs and spices or whatever it is, or some tastemaker in the kingdom, the cupbearer at this time was an incredibly important position. It was sort of the ancient example of our modern Secret Service agent. Artaxerxes I, who we find out is the king that he will be in front of in the next chapter, which we'll save for next week. Artaxerxes and his entire family, they would come to power by killing each other. So it's like, oh, you want to be the king and your older brother that you don't like is there? Let's take him out. And what was the most popular way of killing? Right then, Carolyn took a sip of a Frappuccino. Perfect timing. Ashley, did you taste it first to make sure it's safe? She did not. That's a big risk. Poisoning. That was it. That was how they took him out. So when you're putting your life, the king of the emperor of Persia is putting his life in the hands of Nehemiah. And when he brings him something to eat or drink, he's tested it. So Nehemiah would have a whole network of trusted people involved in the whole food preparation process before it even gets to the king's table. So when he says, oh, by the way, I'm the cupbearer to the king, this means I've got a senior level position and I'm going to have an audience. But you know what? It doesn't matter my position. It doesn't matter my authority. It doesn't matter my moments. All it takes is God. God has to be the one to grant me success, because this is an impossible mission. Who am I? That's another piece. You're the cupbearer to the king and you want to go and rebuild walls? What authority? What credentials do you have? But what he knew was that he served God, who could do anything. And all it takes is for God to have someone willing to step in, and God will use them to do something powerful. I was a cupbearer to the king. What I love about that is that's Nehemiah restating something that we all know to be true. That God had put this calling on Nehemiah's heart. God had given this news to him. He handled it. He wept about it. And then he said, I want to be a part of it. That was something that when you can't explain why you feel like you need to do something for God, that's another way of looking at a calling. And you're like, I don't know how to explain it when I went on that mission trip. I just knew I needed to go. I just felt God wanted me to do that. It's really hard for us to say that stuff in modern times because people are like, well, what are you saying? You like, you got like some special room in your house where you talk to God through some Star Trek machine? You know, like, I mean, you get mocked quite a bit when you talk that way. But when that moment comes and you can't explain it, like, I know I need to do this for God. That's something that God has specifically given to you to use you to do something great. And you look at this and say, who did God place this calling upon? It had been 100 years that these people have been struggling in Jerusalem. For 100 years, who knows how many people were praying and asking God to deliver them, help us, deliver us. And after 100 years, the right person heard the story. His heart was broken. He wept, he fasted, he prayed, and he mourned. He said, God, use me today, use me today, use me today. And next week we see when he had his moment, he takes advantage of it and he was ready for it. What I love about that is to show that God can use anyone. So when you see your neighbor struggling and they're not doing very well and you're like, God, will you send someone to help them? God's like, yes, it's you. I've sent you to them. Oh, well, I thought it was going to be someone else because that's harder than me just asking you to send a total other person. And when that person's at work and they're broken and their hearts are wrecked and they're struggling and they're hurting and they need help, God, will you just help them, heal them, send someone to them? God says, you are their coworker. Why do you think you're here? Step into this moment. To me, that's an exciting thing to me, that we serve a God who wants Rick Chilson to step into moments. He wants Ryan Maxim to step into moments. He wants Pastor Holdridge to step into moments. He wants Ashley Gray to step into moments. He wants Elena Deanna to step into moments. He wants us to step into those moments and say, God, help me in this moment, but I want to meet this need for your glory. That's what this story that we're going to walk through, this book of Nehemiah, is all about. People that saw something that was a calling, saw something that was wrong, and they wanted to do something about it. And a man who was willing to trust God, follow God into an impossible thing. At the first service, I talked about how important it is to have people who run into buildings that are on fire as everyone else runs away. I pointed out Kevin Overton. We got some guys in the back that work with emergency services. Thank you. Because the rest of us are trained by human nature. When the building's on fire, we run. You somehow had this different calling in your heart to run in, not run from. This story is a man, what everyone else wanted to run from that, he ran to that. And as the people of God, there are situations like this all around us. Not just physically in a city, but relationships, friendships, people that have walked away from God, friends of us, people that just desperately need to hear the gospel of Jesus, but see it lived in our lives. When you hear of their plight, does your heart break and you pray and say, God, send someone else to them? Or do you say, God, my heart's broken, I'm weeping, I'm mourning, I'm fasting, and I'm praying, and I say, God, send me to them. Give me the opportunity and the strength and success in the moment. That will transform your faith from being something where you pray a prayer and now you're enlisted into a large country club in which at the end you are going to heaven. That changes that. The gospel of Jesus Christ by grace through faith is an incredible gift, and at the end of our lives when we die, we do spend eternity in paradise, but there's something in between that God wants us to do for him. There's an adventure he wants us to step into. There's a mission he hands each of us. He says to you, Cliff, I didn't just save you from those things. I saved you for these things. There's this person that I want you to step into that moment with and be there for them and share the gospel with them. And your whole life has led to this moment, and I want you to do it. And I'm going to grant you success. I just want you to stand in that moment. That's the God we serve, a God who says, you may be a cupbearer or a lawyer, or you may be a mason, or you may be a homemaker. Masons don't like to be talked about, apparently, publicly. I meant the bricklayer, not the other group. Okay. Somewhere Nicolas Cage is, like, perched This is National Treasure Team. Okay, anyway, sorry. You may be a fireman. You may be a nurse. Just fill that line in. I was cupbearer to the king. I was a pastor of a church in upstate New York. I'm a stay-at-home mom. I'm a firefighter. I'm a teacher. I'm a salesman. Put your name into the story. We're going to walk through it that way each and every week and see what God can do through us in this area as we seek to follow him into the areas that he's leading us. I'm excited to do this study. I hope you guys are too. And as we go into our small group season, we'll be able to discuss it together and go deeper in application. I'm actually just going to close in prayer this morning, and you guys will be dismissed. Will you stand with me as we pray? God, we're so grateful to you for this story. We're so grateful that you've included this in your scripture for us. And God, we can all relate to that moment where you got some heartbreaking news. And God, I pray that as we receive that type of news, that we would not only be saddened and then move on, but that we would be inspired to act for you. So I pray, God, for each of us in this room, I pray that you would even today bring people to mind, situations to mind. God, I want to be like that person that I call when bad things happen. I want to be someone who says, call me back on the way, or I'll call you back in 2 minutes. I've got to get dressed and get in my car, but I'm on my way over. I want to be that type of person, God. Someone who meets needs and runs to the burning building to help those who are in it. I thank you so much for the grace that is ours through the faith we've placed in Jesus Christ alone for our salvation. I pray as a church, we can be a part of a great movement in this area. We know you've got incredible things in store for this area and for each of us and for us as a church, God. We just want to follow your lead. Wherever you lead us, God, we want to follow with reckless abandon and courage. But we know that without your work, without your blessing, there will be no success. So God, we ask you to do great things in us, through us, and around us for your glory. We love you, Jesus. It's in your powerful name we ask it. Amen.